This abstract interpretation for the programmer, only program. Then second is abstract interpretation for the end user, only examples. And then abstract interpretation for the theoretician, only theorems. So you can miss anyone. In principle, it's not harmful. Well, I've invented a new button I was not expecting. Yeah. So here is the content you will discover on the fly. So when you want to analyze a program, you should know what the program is doing first. If you don't know what the program is doing, you only have speculations. And most analyzers speculate on what program do. But here I want to do it seriously. So I do it mathematically. It means pseudo-mathematics here, because it's unwaving. So I consider this program, which is the one on the which the theory of abstract interpretation has been developed, which means I assign 1 to x, I iterate forever by increasing x plus 1, and the only other one I have considered is while x is less than 10. So with these two programs, all the theory was created. So you don't need a lot to think. So you start at point 1. You see, so I have a program points. There is no pointer here. You have a pointer analysis and no pointer. So you have the pointer guy. So thank you. So I put program points here to mean control. They are not part of the language, just decorations. And I have only one variable, which is incremented. It's somewhat trivial. And when I am going to describe what this program is doing, I have states. And states, they are very simple. They are a label which says where I am now. And there is only a value, which is the value of the variable x. So l can be 1, 2, 3, 4. And already I've made a choice, which is this operation is atomic. I cannot decompose it into smaller. So it's not a realistic program, this one. But we don't care. Then when you execute the program, you can model it by a trace, which is the observation of the execution. So I start at program 1, and the value can be anything, any integer. It's not initialized. Then I go to program point 2, and I have assigned 1. Then I go to program point 3, and this has no effects on the value of x, so I still have 1. Then I increment, and after this incrementation, I am at the end of the loop, so I come back to program point 2, I have now x which is 2, I go 3, and so on. So at some point, I have reached some value, I increment, and I come back, and it goes forever, because it's mathematical semantics. I have no constraints on machine, and so on. And it's extremely fast. So the there is a problem here with this slide, but don't worry. So what my trace semantics is just a prefix of all traces. So there are letters that are missing here, but you can imagine that it is this sentence, this trace that is cut at some point, I, and this I can be any integer. So I observe the execution for some time, and then I stop. First question by Danvi.
I said mathematics. Mathematicians don't know about overflow. They are great.
Then you have mathematical invariance, no overflow. So I want to know what is the possible set of states at each program point when I run my program. So it's very simple to get. You do all the run, and you will get these traces. You observe for some time, and as long as you want, you make infinitely many observations, and at the end you have got the set of traces. Then you look at the traces and you collect all the points where you have gone. So you will have 1, 2, 3, you will not have 4 because one does not terminate. And you look at the possible value that you will get. So you will have 1 with any value, 2 with 1 at least, maybe 2 with some other value behind. And you collect all this. And this is an abstraction because you lose information when you do that. When you know only the set of states at each program point, you don't know in which order they appear. So you have forgotten the fact that it was sequences, and you have abstracted sequences into set of states. That's the first abstraction. So I have 2 pointers now, I don't know which one to use. So what we are interested in is this local invariant stuff. So at point 1, I can have any integer. At point 2, I can have only positive 1 because the intuition, it starts at 1 and it's incremented. At point 3, I say I have maybe, yes, at point 3, I have the same that at point 2, that's okay. And at point 4, I have none. So I am interested in that, and there is no overflow. Don't be sleeping. So let's go. Now we have to find a way to compute that mathematically, and we observe that they satisfy equations. So the equations are there. The first equation says when I am at 1, the value can be any value. The second equation says when I am at 2, the value I get is either the one when I come from 1, so it is 1, or the one I get when I was there and I made the incrementation and I come back. So if I have a value which was possible at point 3, then the same value plus 1 will be possible at point 2, because I was there with this value x of variable x. And I made the incrementation, I get this value, I assign it to x, so, and I come back to 2, so at point 2 I can have this value. At point 3, I have to say I come from 2, so I have all the values at 2, and the test must be true. And the test is always true, so I intersect with no condition on x. And at 4, I come from 2, and the test must be false, so I intersect with the set of value for which false is true, which is false. That's the empty set. And now that I have this equation, I have something interesting because I can try to compute these values, set of values at each program point by solving them. So that's the explanation I gave. And our system of equation is of this form. You have at some point the value is obtained by computing the function of the values, possible values at the other point. If you go back, you see at this point it is a function of x3, but I can also consider it's a function of x1, x2, x3, x4 because it just does not depend on some of its parameters. So I can write this function x equal f of x by considering this vector. And it's a fixed point equation because it's of the form x equal f of x. So I have a function that gets a fixed point. And in my case, it has a solution, at least one, the one we are interested in. It may have more than one solution because if I take another solution would be to say that x can have any value. So if I say x has any value at point 2, then it will have any value at point 3, and so it has any value. And I take just empty, any value empty, intersection empty set is empty. So this system of equation has at least two solutions. One which says the thing I was interested in, and another one which says any value is possible at 1, 2, and 3, and no value at 4. So we take the smallest solution. That is the one we are interested in. So how can we solve this equation? We iterate. So we compute iteratively. And when we will compute iteratively, in fact, we will do all execution in parallel. So let's start. So you start from an initial solution, which is everybody is empty. Then you compute x1, which with these four values, by replacing this in the equations. So these values, you put them in the equation, and you compute the new value. So maybe I will do that on this system. If I put empty set here, I get empty set. If I put empty set here, I get empty set. And I've put empty set here, I get empty set. But I have computed this value x1, which is z. So after the first iteration, whoop, I have got this. And also I have computed this one, 1. So after the first iteration, I know that at point, initial point, I have any value, and at point 1, I have only, at point 2, I have only one possibility, which was just assigning and arrive at 2. So after one iteration, I have done initialization, and I have also done go forward one time and from anywhere. And so if you go from the entry to assignment of one, you get that. At the next iteration, I take this value and I put it back in the equation to get the next value. So when I put back in the equation, I get z, the same, 1 plus this for x3, which is empty. Yes, and I get the intersection of x2 with this, and x2 was 1, so I get 1. And here I had 1 intersection empty, so I get false. So I have this new approximation of the solution. So essentially, I move from point 1 to point 2. At the next iteration, I will move to point 3. So I say, I take the previous solution here, approximation, I put it back in the equations, here it is, and I make the computation. So this one says, you take this value, you add 1, you get 2, and you make the union with 1, so I get 1 or 2. So you see, I have come back after the incrementation, I am back at point 2, and simultaneously I have redone the initialization, the assignment of 1. So I do all execution in parallel, if you want, progressing slowly forward. And if I go like this, it will go forever, but mathematicians are good, they know induction. So they say, wow, I have understood how it works. So they say, at the 2nth iteration, if I go on this way, I will find this. I will find that the value initial is any value. At point 2, I have gone up to some n. At point 3, I have the same. And at point 4, I have still empty set. So they do an induction. That is, I compute the next iteration. So I replay this value in the equation. I make the little computation. And you see, now I find n plus 1. I do one more iteration, and now I find n plus 1, n plus 1. So I have proved that my induction hypothesis was okay because it was correct for the first one. You see, you remember, for this one, it was okay for n equal 1. So I had the basis. Now I've made the induction. So it's always true. So the mathematicians have proved that all iterations have this form. and they are infinitely many, so they pass to the limit. So let us pass to the limit. It's n is going to grow forever. So if I make n grow forever, what is the set I will get? It will be the positive numbers. So let's pass to the limit. So here, and I get all the positive numbers, and empty set. And that's it. I have computed the solution. So now program analysis consists in doing something about the fact that this is infinite and that it's difficult to pass to the limit. So there are two difficulties. One is to guess the inductive assertion that I had, that is move from these examples to that. That's not easy. And then the second difficulty is proved by induction that it is true. That's not easy either. And the third difficulty is pass to the limit from that to get this. So, and that's the only problem that static analysis has to solve, plus if it must be machine representable. So here we have a little problem. It's not so easy to represent an arbitrary set of integers in a machine. So we must also solve this problem. So the first thing that we observe is that f is increasing. That is, if you assume that there are more values at any point and you propagate forward, then after one step of propagation, there will be more values. So that's very interesting because this implies that the equation that we have a least solution and the one we are interested. So on the third day, we will speak about that. So now we have to cope with the Henry question, which was a bit early, but we'll do it now. Let's go to a programming language which is more realistic. We have a machine, though it has limited values for integers. So no computer can represent all arbitrary large integers. So in practice, most machines, not all, but most, limit to some interval, which is anything but zero in the middle, usually, or it contains zero always. And the maxint is not zero, the minint is not zero either. So I assume that. And so when we increment forever, when you arrive here, the machine is doing something. So in the old days, when I was a student, the machines were very nice. They were stopping and saying, you have made an overflow, I stop. But the modern machines are much more intelligent. They say stopping is not good, a machine is not made to stop, it should go on whatever is going to happen. So they have various solutions to do that. One might be, if I increment maxint, I stay at maxint. Boop. Another would be, if I stay at maxint, I go to minint, which is most machines are going to do that. So if you understand arithmetic this way, my analysis will become very difficult. I can do it, but it's more difficult. So I will go to the old days where when there is an overflow, it stops. So that's what I say here. So now what is great is everything is finite. Because we have only 2 billion or zillion possibilities, and our modern machines are very powerful, and so we can try all possibilities. This is called model checking. You just try, you take your equation, and you run all possibilities. So let's do it. So I have to first to change the equation. So my equation now changed by saying all initial values must be into maxint minint. And here it says when I increment and the incremented value is in the interval, so this is mathematics because if it's machine, it will overflow. So I will not have it, but it's mathematics. So if the increment is in the interval, I go on. with the value, so I get this new value, but if it is not in the interval, I stop, so there is no new value. So this test here prevents adding a new value which is larger than maxint. And same here, when I do the test, I check that it is in this interval. There are strange languages like Pascal or where you can read a value outside this interval, but when you use it, it must be in the interval, except when you test that it is in this interval. So this can be subtle. So that's why I add it in the test here. And now we can maybe sure that it will always converge because all my sets are finite. And I can represent any set which is finite. So now we have the problem of representing an arbitrary set in a machine which can contain all integers but any subset like the prime numbers. The prime number which rank is not a prime number or things like that. And so it can be very difficult. So one way of solving that is to make further abstraction. So I will make a very simple abstraction which is the interval abstraction. And this will make our representation very easy. So the interval abstraction is very easy. We use intervals, that is pairs of numbers. And with two numbers, I represent in my machine the set of all integers that are between these bounds. So I have solved the representation problem because any set will be represented by two integers, and anyone knows that I can put two integers in a machine. The only problem I have is that I may have the empty set, so I have to find some representation for that. And the abstraction will be this. Whenever I have a set to approximate, I just remember the minimum value and the maximum value. Professors do that on exam. They say my lowest mark must not be too low and my highest mark must be excellent. So, and the middle doesn't, I don't care too much. So, and I will try to have the, to choose the interval to make my student happy. So, you, or on roads also, you have this abstraction. You have a maximum limit, and no one say a minimum limit. It means no one say on the highway you should not go backward. It's it's implicit, but you have an interval which is something above zero and the max limit. And any other value in between is okay. So if we do that, we have to transform our equation into intervals. And the whole purpose of abstract interpretation is to explain you how to do it. So if I give you the first equation and you say, I take the interval abstraction, there is only one way to make it work with interval, which is this way. I hope I am not wrong because I did it with my nose, with not with mathematics. But mathematically, there is only one solution. And so we will see that in course 3. And in our case, it's very simple. The first one, we lose absolutely no information because we had already the interval. Here we know that one is in this interval. And we say, if X3 is the empty set, because we don't have a representation for empty interval, so we have to use one, which is empty set, then we return empty set. Otherwise, it was an interval, so after the loop, I was in an interval, and I have to change this interval to make the incrementation. So I make the incrementation, and I see if it does not overflow on the lower bound. I do the same on the upper bound, and I keep what is good. That is, if there is no overflow, this will be smaller than that, so I will take b plus 1. And if there is an overflow, that is b is maxint, for example, the minimum will be Maxine, and so I will give the maximum. I will keep the maximum. That's okay? So this is exactly the computation we were doing before, but now I do it, instead of doing it on the elements of the set, I do it on the interval. So I get this new interval, and here I have to transform the all integers between this bound into an interval, so that's trivial. And here I have to transform the set, the empty set, into an interval, and we have this special representation. So now we have got a thing which is much simpler because we have a trivial representation of interval by pairs of integers. So we have four pairs of integers and we can easily represent that in the machine. So now we have this thing which was the union. And the union of sets was a set, but the union of interval may not be an interval. If you take two intervals like this, the result is not an interval. So because I reason only on intervals, I must transform a union of two in interval into an interval. So it's very easy. You take the two and you say it's this interval here. So that's what I define here. You take the two intervals, you take the minimum and the maximum. So if it's like this, I take the minimum, this one, and the maximum, these two, this one, and I get the interval. Now we had also this, which was the intersection for the test. So we must define it for intervals now, because the intersection of intervals, is it always an interval? Yes. It's either empty or an interval, but anyway, we must define it. So when they overlap, you just take the middle, and when they do not overlap, it is the empty set. And now we have done another approximation, because if you have 1, 2, 5, which was one set, we will get the approximation by 1, 5, and so we introduce values 3 and 4 that did not exist, so we have more values than in the interval than we have in the set. This means that when we will solve the equation with intervals, we will find more values than we could have found using sets. But that's okay, because if you have more values, you have more program behaviors. And if you have more pre-program behaviors, you are sound, that is, you do not forget a case. You are in bad shape if you want to prove exists something. If you want to prove that there exists two in the set here, by looking at the set, I say, yes, two is there. But if I look here and I want to prove there exists a value two during execution, I can prove nothing. Because if I choose 3, you see, it's not. And if I choose 2, it is. So how do I find? No way. So by doing this interval stuff, we have lost every possibility of proving existence of things. We have kept all possibilities of proving for all. Yes?
So when would you really offer the music?
Never.
Because no one cares about exist. Either it's finite, it's trivial, you try all cases until you find one, or it is infinite and you can do nothing. You can only take some execution and run them for some time. That's called testing. That's it. And all the people that do exist in the abstract never speak on the value of this exist in the concrete. So if you listen carefully at model shaking people, they take a model, they prove existence in the model, and they don't tell you whether it's true or not in the original thing that they never speak about. So proving that there exists something in the model proves nothing in the concrete, but because they don't speak about the concrete, is very nice. So taking finite and not speaking of the concrete is model checking. We are in the other case We take infinite and we speak in the concrete, and that's become very difficult. So, yes, I explained that. So now we are going to write programs for that. And maybe you don't know OCaml, which is a functional programming language. So I thought you will learn a new language and abstract interpretation all at the same time. That's very nice. So the abstract interpreter reads a program, builds more or less the interval equations that we have seen, and then solve them. So we will not go to this part where you read a program and you build the equation, because it's like a compilation course. In compilation, you read the program and you build something. Here it's equation. In compilation, it's intermediate language, but it's almost the same. So I assume you can do this part alone. You have all followed the compilation course. If you have not, it's too late. You have to follow one next year. And I will assume that here I start from the equation, more or less. So now we have to see how we should encode the equations. So that's not so simple, because you have several people that do very different things. So some will build a database, or data representation of the equation. And we say an equation is a left member, a right member. A right member is an expression, so it's a tree. And they will build this tree. And then when you ask, we have the problem of when I give you values for some function, you have to answer what is the f of these values to apply the function. They will write an interpreter which interpret the tree and build the equations. That's one way. Another way that we will follow is say an equation is a function, so we will encode the equation as a function. And so when you call the function, it evaluates the equation. So my encoding here of the system of equation will be a system of function, one function for each component. When you call the function with argument, it evaluates this component. I did that because the alternative of having a tree and going with an interpreter and so on is more difficult and less efficient. So first we have to implement intervals. So we choose a type which says it can be empty, and otherwise it's a pair of a lower bound and upper bound, which is between maxint and minint. But it's unfortunate that in OCaml, the minint and the maxint are not the same as the machine. Yes, because there is one bit for the garbage collector. And so they keep one, every integer, they will keep one bit for the garbage collector, and the rest will be the machine integer usual. So I have, you see, one bit less. And so my values are not exactly the same as the one in the previous slide. I could also have two integers, because there are libraries that do that. But then I have to write a plus with some symbol behind it. And so it's not as beautiful. So I went to the simple solution. So now we have to encode the basic operation. One is inclusion of interval. Then one is a union, intersection. We must print something, because otherwise we would have no result. And we must increment the interval by one. So in practice you need more, but here is the code. So we will read the code. You are programmers, you read code. So the type of interval is either it's empty or it's an interval. And in that case it's a pair of integers. Now, to check that an interval x is included in an interval y, I just see if the first is empty. In that case, the empty set is included in anything, so I return true. In the second case, I check if the second argument is empty. And so the first argument will not be empty, because if it would have been empty, I would have chosen the first case. So here I know this is not empty, so it's an interval. And no interval which is not empty is included in the empty set, so I return false. Otherwise, the only possibility is to have two intervals here, A, B, C, D. And they are included if they are like this. I check one, this one is inside this one. So you see this one is inside this one. And when I compile, the compiler tells me I have forgotten no case, so looks good. So now the union. So if I make the union with the empty set, it is the other alternative. And if I have two integers interval here, what I do is, the union, yes, of non-empty interval is never empty. That's okay. And the lower bound, when I make the union, is the smallest of the two here. And the larger upper bound is the larger of the two. Great. The meat. So if one of the arguments is empty, the intersection will be the empty set. And otherwise, I have to check whether the two intervals do not overlap. So here, I tell that they do not overlap. In that case, I return empty. And if this is false, this means that they do overlap. So if they do overlap, for the lower bound, I take the larger one. And for the upper bound, I take the smaller one. So I take the larger lower bound and the smaller upper bound. And I get the interval. So now for addition, we have to add one to an interval. So we get the interval shifted by one. But we must not do any overflow when you do that. So we say if the interval is empty, when you add one, it means empty, because you have no value before execution, and you are asked what is the value after incrementing. So it's no value. Now if you have an interval, you check that there is no overflow, and in that case you return the upper bound incremented, it's what here? Yes, it's the lower bound. So you check that the lower bound does, when you increment it, will not make an overflow. So here I check that. And then you return the lower bound incremented by one. Otherwise, you return the upper bound. And same for the upper bound. You check that it will not make an overflow when you increment. In that case, you return the upper bound incremented by one. Otherwise, boof, you... So where was there? I was there. So I say for the low upper bound, you check the overflow, you return the increment, otherwise the maximum. And to print, you see, you just see if it's empty, and I print something like this, which means bottom. And otherwise I print an interval with a parenthesis, a colon, and a parenthesis and two values. That's okay? So that's what is called an abstract domain. It's something, the element of the abstract domains are properties. So here it's a property belong to an interval. And you have operation on these properties. You have implies, which is less. You have disjunction, which is joined. We have intersection, which is meet. You have push a property forward, the predicate transformer, and you have print properties. So we have done one thing, is that we can represent values as intervals of variables. Now in general, you have more than one variable, so you must have another abstract domain which will map variables to intervals. In my example, I have only one variable, so I don't do it. I just, instead of having a map from variable to intervals and to have equation that handle this case, I think, I don't remember, but I think I will just not do it. But if you have to do it, then you do interval operation variable by variable. It's a Cartesian projection, that is, I care of one variable at the time, and I do not maintain any relationship between variables. So that's a very simple model, and that's why people think abstract interpreter, because you see, they say you have values assigned to variable, and when you execute, it's more or less like an execution. But in general, I don't have anything like this, so it's harder to have a notion of interpreter. So now we have to express the fact that at each program point, we associate some information, which is what the set of values during execution. So that's abstract invariant. We have these 4 points, and at each point, we say what are the possible values of the variable. So this is a difficult problem, because if you have 1 million lines, of course, you cannot represent in your machine 1 million environments. So what you do, you represent only the one at loops, one for per loop. But in my case, it's very simple, so I just take a vector of one invariant per program point. It makes things simple. And then we have to extend implication from variable, it was inclusion in variable, to interval, it's inclusion for each variable, to invariant, it's inclusion for each invariant. So it's pointwise. So I have to write this library that goes from interval for variables to environment for variables to program point for environment for variables. And we have skipped the environment part in my example. But we need to go to the invariant part. So I say now I have invariants. And you see my invariants are very simple. They are quadruple of interval, one for each program point. I have not made any effort. I should have something better. And the inclusion of intervals, invariant, is just, you see, inclusion for the first, inclusion for the second, inclusion for the third, inclusion for the fourth. And less, what is this one? C less and P less. I don't see. Yes. What is this stuff? P less, x and x prime. I'm missing the type. When you type something, the compiler gives you the type, and I am missing them.
It's tuples with 4 elements.
Yes, you are given.
If they're all less for x than for x prime, then you can choose.
So I make the comparison. Yes. It's this one returns 4 booleans. You see, 1, 2, 3, 4. And this one returns the conjunction of these 4 booleans. Thanks for the help. Who was a great programmer? The one. Great. Then greater is the inverse of less. So I just exchange the parameters. Empty is just empty everywhere. The meat is just component-wise. And the print is just at point 1 I have x1, at point 2 I have x2, at point 3 I have x3, and point 4 I have x4. Very simple. So now we must iterate. You have a question?
Just a terminology question. Does variant refer to a particular program point or the set of all program
points to be simple? I mentioned before that I cannot scale this way. So in practice, you do it only for 1 point per loop or something like that, or even less. But it's more difficult.
What would you call that? 1 point or collection of all those
points? I don't.
Because it might not even be an invariant. In practice, it's not an invariant. because I can explain, I will explain that later. So now we must iterate. So the iterator, you remember, we start from some value, we apply some function, we apply some function, we apply some function, we go on forever, and at some point or never, we will reach something which is stable. So because we are doing model shaking presently, but on intervals, we can stop here. It's a bit technical. I stop at a postfix point, which is f of x is less than x, because this will be an increasing sequence for some reason that I will explain later. And so when I stop at a postfix point, this one implies the other direction, and so I will stop at a fixed point. And this will be the smallest, because of mathematics that say, because this is under the fixed point, when you iterate, you stay below, because f is isotone or in monotone. So it's okay. So of course this can go forever, but our terminal intervals are finite, so it will always converge in our case. So here is a fixed point computation. So to compute the least fixed point, I need the starting point, I need the function, and I need the order. You see this one where I stop. So I stop at f of x is less than x. Then I say, let's do one step. So I have iterated up to some point, and now I am at iteration x. I must do the next one. So next one is f of x. I call it y. And I check if y is less than x. So if y is less than x, it means f of x is less than x. Then, you remember here, I say when I have this, I stop. And I return the first x. Otherwise, I have not reach a fixed point, so I go on with my iteration with the next iterate, which is y. So you see, when you call iterate with an initial value, it will apply f here, then return f of a of the initial value, compute the ff, return it, ff, do one more iteration, it will go like this, FFFFFFF of the initial value, and maybe it will go forever, or it will stop here because I have this condition, and in that case I will have a fixed point. So this iterator may iterate forever, but in our case, because intervals are finite, it will stop. And so to compute the least fixed point, I start from the initial value, and I start my iteration from it. It's nice, functional programming is great. So we have what is called a Jacobi iteration, that is the next vector of invariant is a function of, for each component applied to the previous vector. So this is not the best method, and in practice we do not use this one. But all the methods you use in practice should be equivalent to this one, so why not use the simplest one? So now we must implement the equations. So what we have a representation of this. We have an implementation of all these operations, here, the add, intersection, union. We have a representation of equation, operation on working on vectors here. So I have an operation that will compare one vector to the next one. I have and I must now represent this system of equation. So I represent it by code. So the code takes this vector of 4, x1, x2, x3, x4. It computes that and it gives me the next values. So it's encoded here. I have the four values of, here it's x3, here is x2, there should be an x2 somewhere here. And I compute the next four. So the first one is this one, it's min in, max in, very simple. The second one is this one, so it is a joint of this interval, which is interval 1, 1. I make the joint, and then I have this operation, which is exactly add 1. So it takes the intervals, it checks if it's empty it returns empty, otherwise it shifts it right, taking the maxint into account. Then this one is the meet intersection of x2 and this interval, which is this value. And this one is the meet of x2 and this interval, which is empty. I could, of course, make some simplification and write empty here, but I'm stupid. I just do as it is in the equation. So now this is a function, so I can call it. And when I call it with arguments, it will take a vector of values, compute all this, and give me the next one. So now we are done. We just have to start with empty everywhere, apply the iterator with this function, wait, and see. So let's do that. So the analyzer is very simple. I start with the function that we have seen. The initial value is the vector with bottom everywhere. The less is component-wise go forever. And my iterator, when it returns some value, if ever, I print it component-wise. And that's it. And so I have defined the analyzer and I call it. And now I can run. So here is a result, so I compile. You see all my modules here. And I run the result. And I get what I want, that is, this is an initial interval. At point 2 is greater than 1. At point 3 is greater than 1. And at point 4, I never reach it. What is interesting is this time here, which is not so bad. Maybe it's a few seconds, so we are happy. That's in fact, model checking done on interval instead of doing all on sets. And if you look at the iterates, so now I have inserted a print in my least fixed point. It starts from empty set, and you see that it grows slowly where we were doing like this until reaching the maximum, and then the maximum interval, when you do one more iteration, it will overflow, so it will be cut back to this one, and so the next iterate will be the same. We have found the solution. That's okay. So I have explained that already. And of course, the conversion is extremely slow. Alors, I don't know, but it's not very... Oh, yes, I see. 52 minutes, 49 seconds. For a program, 4 lines, 1 variable. So now you go 1 million line, 50,000 variable, which is a size we can handle easily. Then you imagine the result. But then you say machine will progress. And so if machine progress, the problem is that the size of program is also progressing. And already we have lost information, which is intervals. So we must do something about it. Let's do it. So it's called convergence acceleration, and it's the idea that you cannot afford going through the iterates as stupid mathematicians would do. You have to do some inference. And inference is extremely difficult because if you try to find the general term of the iterates, it's something not obvious. Prove that it's stable, that is next iterate as a subform is not obvious, and passing to the limit is even less obvious. So we have to make this obvious. So to make this obvious, one thing is go to finite case. And intervals are infinite or large, go to something small like signs. So you just go to positive, negative, and I don't know, and empty. So if we do that on our program, if we go to strictly positive, positive, we will have the same result, it will be fast. But then we have some result in abstract interpretation that says if you go finite, we can always do better than you. So if you go finite and you don't know abstract interpretation, then anyone knowing abstract interpretation will propose a solution which is both more precise and most often more efficient, more faster. So this is because of convergence acceleration. So I stopped that because that was what I said. And we will start with widening. That is, the idea is because we go upward slowly, if you jump, you will go faster. Whoop. So we have iterates. So we start from bottom, which was the infimum. We iterate, we pass to the limit. And what we will do is we will say, take two consecutive terms in this iteration. So the previous term, xn, and the next term, and apply some magical operation which we call widening, which give you the next term, and this must have two properties. It must be sound, so this means that we must overshoot the limit because we said we are sound if we take more cases than in reality. And second property, it must terminate. Now, if you have any solution to solve this problem, what you have done, you have started with bottom, you have computed some iterate, and you have done something in between. And this something, I call it a widening. So a widening, when there is no way to escape, if there is an infinite iteration, there exists a widening that you are doing. Maybe you don't know that it is a widening, but you do one. So most solutions that you see in the literature are widening that don't say that they are widenings. So let's go to... So now, when we do the widening, I come back to this condition that I will prove. If we reach a post-fixed point, then we are sure to be above the least fixed point. So because we must overshoot the fixed point, one way would be to compute it and then see if you are above, but we don't want to compute it. So we have to have a way where, not knowing the fixed point, we must know that we are above it. And this way is this one, which follows from Tarski's theorem, the fact that f is isotone or monotone, and so this implies that if we have a post-fixed point, we stop here over the least fixed point. So the first thing is that if we have previous iteration, that will be the next, and that would have been the next without widening. If you remember, this is a previous operation, this is the next without widening, and this one is the next with widening. So when we have a widening, we have previous operation, iteration, next iteration, and next iteration with extrapolation. So what we require is that if you have this, that is, you are above the previous iteration, and we also require this, you are above the next iteration. So the regular iteration, you always are above. So if you are always above the regular iteration, and the iteration regular one reaches the least fixed point, you will arrive above. Then you must do that only a finite number of times. because otherwise your program will diverge. So that the second condition that we say a widening must be such that when you apply it, it enforces convergence after finitely many steps. And there is no other way. If you terminate, you have this property. So now we have to find interesting widenings, and that's a very difficult subject. So most people come to see me and say, how do you design widening? And I don't know. I do it because I have done it before. It's like asking a mathematician, how do you prove theorems? He proves theorem because he has proved theorem before. So the next one he knows because he knows previous one. So you try, if it does not work, you improve. So for interval, here is a widening which is bad, in fact, but it works. So the first iterate is empty. So at the next iterate, that is just before after the first one, I will not make any extrapolation. Now I have made iteration, I go back to empty. That's, this case never happens, so I can take anything. If I take x, it's okay, I satisfy my conditions. And now is interesting case is here. I have an interval. I have the next interval in the iterates. And I must do something that enforces termination and is greater. And here it is. I say, if the lower bound is decreasing, so I add an interval, and next one is smaller on the lower bound, so it's smaller here. I put the lower bound to minint, or minus infinity in math. If I do that, I'm sure next time it will not go below. And same for the upper bound, if it has moved larger, I put it to plus infinity, and so it will not change. So that's a very stupid thing. It will terminate because when I apply it, either I have never this case, so I will find the true interval, or one bound is going down or up, it will go to infinity. Then what happens, next one will go down or up, it will go to infinity. And I have finitely many variables, and I have finitely many program points, so it will terminate. So here is what happened in practice. You see, you start from empty set, then you have program execution that start. Then you have initial value, you have next value, we have approximated by an interval, and maybe here we say, look, these two constraints are not stable, so we keep only the other two here, and we get this zone. So the general idea of widening one intuition is when there is a course of computation, you observe the things that are not stable, and you do something about them. So ignoring the constant is one easy solution. So now you are in a mess because the widening is not monotonic. So if I take 1 is less than 2, and if I do the widening of 0,1 by 0,2, this bound is not stable, I put it to plus infinity. Now if I do 0,2 widened by 0,2, this is the same, so I keep it. And so you see that this is included in that. So this is included in that, this is the same, but this is not included in that, so it's not monotonic. This means that if you improve things, because of the widening, your analysis might be less precise. So you say, I make it monotonic, everyone knows that monotony is the basis of static analysis. The problem is that if you make it monotonic, it cannot be a widening. So this is provable. Either it will be unsound, or it will be sound but not terminate. So that's life. If you jump over fixed point in a monotonic set, on a monotonic function, you cannot be monotonic. Because if you have a monotonic function, if you don't jump, you will stay below the fixed point. And so jumping by application of a monotonic function cannot be monotonic because this function brings you always below. So there is no way to go above without applying some operation which is not monotonic. That's the intuition. Oh, let's go. We will do it anyway. So let's encode the widening. If it's empty, we keep the second term. If the second is empty, we keep the first. And if we have two intervals, we look at the new value, which is if you decrease, you go to minus infinity, otherwise you keep the old one. If you increase the upper bound, then you go to plus infinity, otherwise you keep the old one, and I return these two values. So now we have to implement the widening for environments, that is for each variable. So we can widen variable per variable. Then we have to implement widening for vectors of invariance. And what do I have done here? Ah, I'm not so stupid. I do a widening only once per loop. Because if something does not converge in the equation, there must be a loop in the program. And only that loop can bring infinite iteration. Otherwise, it's just symbolic execution with constant propagation, value propagation. So only loops can introduce infinite iteration. And if I do a widening anywhere in the loop, it will converge at that point, and so it will converge in the loop, provided I have not lost one part. So here I do the widening at point 2. And otherwise, I do nothing. So my widening for invariant is widen for interval at, for environment at point 2. My widening for environment is widen on each variable. And my widening on variable is this one. So now we have to re-implement the abstract interpreter. And here it is. We say, instead of iterating the function f, we define a new function with widening. And this new function is, you take the previous iterate, you apply the function, and you get a result which is a widened result. And so this function, now I iterate it with my fixed point operator. And so instead of doing f of f of f, it will do, that's a magic button. This one, I don't know how to... Yes, I have not found. So, it's strange. Wrong, not this one. Yes, so this is iterate from bottom everywhere. I cannot have two ends. So I will show with my pointer. So it says iterate from bottom everywhere while until all invariants are stable. This function, which is just iterate f and just perform a widening at each step. So now we apply it to our program. We just compile. You see, because our program is a program itself, it works only for one program, but I have said you can generate this program automatically. And now it takes zero time. And the result is the same. So we have moved from 52 minutes to zero. And when you look at the iterates, it's like this. You start from bottom. You have here a widening that goes on. Then you see this one get plus 1, it's widened, and I make the union of 2, so next one I get this one, and then this propagates, and this is stable. That's great. So, of course, it speed up convergence, but it loses information because it jumps. So if I modify my little program like this and say, while it is less than 100, do increment. So to do that, I have just to change these two equations into, here I go from x2 to x3. by taking all the values of x at point 2 and then remembering only the ones that are less than 100. And here I go there. If I have, I am at point 2 and the value is greater than 101. I assume there is no overflow here. So I have to check Maxine is less than 101, but it is. So if we do the analysis of this program, so what we have changed is the program only with this analyzer. What we get, you see, if I do without widening, what I get is anything, 101, inside the loop 100, and an exit is 101. And it's relatively fast because, you see, it's fast because I have only 100 iterations. But if I go to, yes, I skip that. If I go to widening, so I do the same now with widening, I get here it's good, here it's not so good, here it's good, and here it's not so good. So I have lost precision compared to the best I could do by just iterating stupidly. And maybe very long time. So the trick is that when you have 100 and you increment, it will give you 101, and this will do a widening, so it will go to top. So I will have 1 plus infinity at point 2. When I go inside the loop, I have 100 that cut this. But when I go outside the loop, it says it's greater than 101, and this is lost forever. So when I have lost this information, there is no way to recover it. So now we are above the least fixed point, so we went from below to above. We are above, and we have a post-fixed point. So 1 iterate is below, 2 iterate is even below, 3 iterate is even below. And so we can go down now from the solution we have found. I've got a question.
So why do we take such big jumps when we're widening?
Oh, because I take the most stupid widening I could find. In practice, we don't use this one. But whichever you use, at some point you will have to do a big jump. So why not explain to poor student the simple case, let's go stupidly, and then if they understand better, you say, yeah, but you see, it's not the true story, it's pedagogy. I want you to remember, do big jumps, because there is no way out of that, sometime. Here, it's every time, but sometime is enough. And even if you have done big jump, you can improve. So the idea is this one. We have stopped something greater than the least fixed point, which is a post-fixed point. F is monotonic, so F2 of A is less than F of A, which is less than A. F3 of A is less than F2, which is less than F, which is less than A. And so by recurrence, Fn of A is less than A, and also greater than the least fixed point. So just going down any time will improve the solution. Except if we were lucky or not, I don't know. Except if we had reached a fixed point here. If we had reached a fixed point by iterating, we stay there. So there is this case where we can do nothing. And here, if we have not reached a fixed point, we improve. Now we must speed this up because it may be very slow. We may have a large interval, and by one we decrease slowly until we get the empty interval. So we want to do these iterations, but stop them and be sound. So to stop is very easy. You say invent some method that force termination, and be sound is more subtle because you go down. And you must not jump over the least fixed point. Because if you jump over the least fixed point, you will be below. And it's incorrect. You must always be above. The trick is you don't want to go over the least fixed point, but you don't know the least fixed point. So you say, I will not jump over any fixed point. So that's better, because if you don't jump over any fixed point, you are sure to not jump over the least one. But you don't know all the fixed points, so that does not improve the story. So what I say, I will say, this is correct. So if I stay in between, I am correct also. So I will go down, but not as fast as it possible. And if I go down, but not as fast, and the one going faster than me is correct, I will be correct because I will be above the faster one, and this faster one is correct because of monotonicity. That's okay? So this operation, I call it a narrowing. And I write it this way because it's widening is like a union, and this is like an intersection. So you see, it's like an intersection. So I call it a narrowing. I say it starts from the previous iterate, takes the next one, makes some magic, compute the next iterate. Then two conditions, it must enforce termination, and it must not jump, it must remain above this one. And it must be below this one, otherwise you have no improvement. And this one was smaller than this one because of monotonicity and the stopping condition here. So here it is, what I explained, and convergence, you just say, I want it to converge. And here is an example for intervals. So I say, if I do a narrowing with empty set, I keep empty set. And if I have two intervals, if one is infinity and the next one is a constant, so if one is infinity and the C is a constant, or anything, because it can be minus infinity also, I keep the second one. Otherwise, if it's not infinity, it's a number, I may have the upper bound, the lower bound that goes up very slowly, so I may be in a case of non-termination. So I don't want to do this, so I take the old one, the smallest one. And same for the above. I have this iteration, next one is here. If this is infinity, I take this one. If this is not infinity, I take this one. So this will terminate because I have finitely many points, infinitely many variables, and in this variable there are finitely many infinities. And by dropping them one by one, I can do at most two times the number of variables. This terminates, and this improves, and it's above because you are always between these two intervals with my definition. So let's do it. So the idea is this, I have previous iterate, next iterate, I keep the next iterate. I have previous iterate, next iterate, I can keep anything in between. Not smaller. So let's just implement. We define a narrowing operation for intervals, empty, empty. Otherwise, if one bound is minus infinity, take the other one, else keep the smallest. If the upper bound is plus infinity, take the next iterate, otherwise keep the previous. And narrowing, we have to do it for environment. I do it variable per variable. Then for invariant, I do it only for the loop. Because I lost information at the loop, I just reintroduce precision at the loop. And otherwise, it will propagate. That's it. And now the abstract interpreter. So it's very easy. First phase, I define my widening. So I take iterate, next iterate, I do widening. That's a new function that I iterate from bottom. I get a result, which is a postfix point. And next, I reiterate starting from this result. So you see the result of the widening phase. I restart with it. And now I restart with a new function, which is f with narrowing. So that's the previous iterate. Next iterate, I apply the narrowing, and this is the result. Now you see, when I go up, I have prefixed point and I stop at a postfixed point and I get a fixed point or a postfixed point. Here, when I go down, I have postfixed point and so I stop at a prefixed point and by the intersection I will stop at a fixed point. That's okay, so that's a kind of dual, you see, so I have less here, I have greater, because here I go up, I stop when I go in the next direction, here I go down and I stop when I go in the other direction, and I reach a fixed point. That's okay, so my analogy is this one now. So let's have a look at our little program. We made it, because now, you see, the narrowing, I just found a good solution here. So if we look at the iterates, so you have the first phase, I start from bottom everywhere, then it increases, it do the widening. Inside the loop, I have always the same result, it's okay because I was protected by the test. But now at next iteration, it's not really, I converge here. So next, what will happen? What will happen? At point 2, we have plus infinity. When we make one more iteration, we come from point 3, we get 201, or we come from point 1, so we have 101. And now we made the narrowing of this by 101. So the 1 stays the same. This is plus infinity, it goes to 101 here. So at point 2, we have 101. When we go one more into the loop, it's the same because 101 intersection 100, I get the same. But now when I go outside, 101 intersection greater than 101 give me 101, 101. That's okay? So let's try some other button. Yeah, not this one. So, yes, very important. There is no magic. It is because the problem is undecidable. If I do widening, I lose information. If I do narrowing, I get better information. But in all cases, I have infinitely many programs for which I will fail. It's very easy. You find one where you fail and you just include it in some loop or anything forever. And so you can very easily write a program that provides counterexample to any static analyzer. Yes. So you have misunderstandings. Here is an example. So widening starts from below, arrive above. Narrowing is not the dual, because the dual of below above is above below. And the narrowing is to start from above and you arrive above the least fixed point. And the dual of this is below below. So this is the way you handle exist. So if you want to prove exist, you have to find a dual widening and a dual narrowing. In my thesis, I gave the example testing. And no one has ever found a better example. And no one has ever found useful things here, useful thing to do. Here you have infinitely many examples. That's very easy. So taking the dual is extremely complicated in practice. Mathematically, it's a triviality. So mathematics are sometimes trivial, in practice is more difficult. So in practice, abstract interpreters do not work for one program, but they take the program as a parameter and they produce some representation of the equation. So the transformer can be generated from the program test, and people call that abstract compilers as opposed to abstract interpreters. I don't know at which time I stop. Now, so it looks a good point to stop. Huh? And yes, that's it. And verification, yeah. little of verification. So a verifier, you give him something to prove. So what he will do is find the invariant and then prove it. So so now I have this little poem. You see, I have just declared that x should be between 1 and 100. And I have written this, so there is an error here. Should be strictly less. And so I want to check that this poem is correct. So the interval equation, they take... No, yes, they take the declaration into account. You see, so here I have intersected with the declaration. I have not intersected here, but I should have. And here I have not intersected, but I should have also. But the main point is here. So what I do the analysis as if the poem were correct. I say, if they want me to prove this, let us assume it's true and make the analysis with this assumption. So we do it. So I change a little the equations. And yes, we do it. Yes, so I have to explain that. As if it's correct. Then we have a result, which is the invariant at each program point under the hypothesis that the declaration is correct. Then I propagate one step forward. If this step forward remains in the scope of the declaration, it's okay. Because it was an induction hypothesis that the declaration was correct. I found with this induction hypothesis that the interval must be this. And when I propagate forward, I prove my induction hypothesis is correct. And so now it's okay. What you said is correct. Now if I make the analysis under the assumption and I propagate forward and it goes out of the interval, then I prove nothing, and so I must say maybe it's wrong. Why I should say maybe and not you are wrong is because interval lose information, so the program might be correct for some strange reason I have not captured with intervals. So now the verifier is very simple. You translate the declaration into something which must be true at each program point. So here I have just done the loop invariant should satisfy the declaration. In practice, it's more difficult because it's everywhere in the program. And then you have the verifier. So the verifier is very simple, except that I don't remember it. Yes. So you give to the verifier some solution computed by analysis. You give it the F that propagates forward. You give it the declaration. It checks that going forward one step is included in the declaration at each program point. So I have my vector of each program point where it is true, and I print a warning. And the warning is there is an error at each program point where the condition is not met. So in our case, we just say we compute with widening narrowing and then we verify. And our example says there is an error because you have declared 100 and you check 100 and you increment by 1, so there might be an overflow. So you change the program or the declaration. I change the declaration. And now you redo everything. Where is it? Yes, it says nothing, so it's good, like Unix. Conclusion, it works. It's more complicated than that, much more, but you have the basic ideas. So this is some analyzer which is based on the principle I have explained, which has more than one abstraction. It has about 30, 32 abstractions. And it analyzed program of 1 million lines, 50,000 variables. So it's huge in one shot. It's a bit long. It takes about 30. It can take, depending on the program, 2 to 35 hours. But testing this program, running the test, is 1 month on infinitely many machines. And our 34 hours are one machine and only 34 hours. So if you want to buy it, you can now. It's sold. And if you are academic, you have a fair price. The other one is fair. It's 40,000 euros, which is $60,000 or $50,000. It's not too much. Now, if you have an industry where the risk of having a bug is that the whole industry is going to disappear, then they will spend $50,000. The trick is that it is precise because it has a very precise objective, which is embedded code, embedded control command code. So there are abstractions that I will show tomorrow which are specific for this kind of application. So if you use this analyzer on this application, it's marvelous. If you use it on business models for written in C, for doing some banking with error everywhere, it will not work because it's not done for that. So the second idea is that if you choose the abstraction just for the application domain, then you can be very precise. And we have no alarm. That is, we have tuned the abstraction until we reach no alarm. And from time to time, there is a new one that appears. So this one creates hundreds of others. So the first problem is, among the hundreds, which one was the origin? You understand the problem. You introduce some new abstraction. You include it in the abstract interpreter, and that's it. So I'm late, as usual.